Hello. Welcome back to the David Watson podcast. One of the things I'm grateful for when I'm doing these podcasts is genuinely the guests I get to speak to. And no more so than today when I spoke with Wesley, and largely because of the relaxed environment, and his wife got involved as well. And it was just fantastic. It was a brilliant conversation. And the conversation was structured around the book that Wesley wrote called Today, Oh Boy, and it's based in 1970 and at a high school. And one of the things we all reminisced about is what secondary, senior, high school, whatever country you're in, what it meant to us, and the icons that surrounded the influences in those informative years. I really love talking to them. I hope you enjoy it too. And as always, please do check out today's guest, Wesley. Check out his book, check out his website. He has a website where he writes and he has his blogs. And I don't doubt for one second, they're great. Hello, welcome to the David Watson podcast. It's very nice to meet you. How are you doing right now?
I'm fine, David. How are you doing?
I'm good.
My wife, Caroline Moore, is here. She's the editor of the book and a professional editor, obviously. So she might add some spice to our discussion.
Well, hey, everybody.
Hello. So we'll just quickly ask, what is it like sort of editing for your husband's book?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I'll put you on the spot. So,
well, actually, you know, it's a bit of a conflict of interest, I must say, because it was the very first thing that he handed to me when we started dating was this manuscript. And he wanted me to say, you're a genius. I love it. I'm just bowled over. And I did think all those things. But I also said, what do you want to do with this? Because it's about 80% there. And I think he was a bit taken aback. But long story short, here we are. I didn't really do much with the content, but I did a lot of line editing. And of course, the small things that get it to that point where you feel confident to submit it to a publisher.
Is it possible that he didn't really care and he just seen the woman? It's like, I need to marry that lady and I'll start a conversation.
Indeed.
Well, actually, because it takes place in 1970 and I'm obviously a bit older than Caroline, I said, Caroline, would you like to know what I was like in high school?
Nice line. I only gave her
the first chapter. I didn't give her the entire manuscript.
You've got to make them work for it. You've got to make them work for it. But that's a nice line. I like that. And it worked. You're married.
Yeah, we're married. Yeah.
We're still married after all these 6 years.
No, congratulations. That's really nice. I like that. That's a really nice way to sort of have the introduction and start a conversation. And you gave her an opportunity straight away to say, right, now that we're interested, this is how I'm going to improve you. We'll start with your
book.
Well, I'm an editor. I'm always looking for things to tweak. So, that can be an uncomfortable position for a poor dear husband. But, we're still here and we're making progress.
No, it's good. It's good.
Really fun ride. He has gotten a lot of attention from this book. It's been incredible. An incredible experience, and it's still going. You know, the book came out March 31st was the pub date of last year, and I feel like it's getting more press now than it was even 3 months ago and 3 months before that. And so it's just, there's a lot of attention to the book, and I think there are a lot of great cultural reasons why. But I'll let Wesley take the floor for that.
No problem. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate that. Before we get into a little bit more about the book, I want to jump to a completely different question, because in the press release that was sent to me, it says you dabble in fake painting, and I have never heard of that, and I just need to scratch that curiosity before I carry on the conversation, if I may.
Okay, yeah. I call them fake paintings because they're photo collages. Here's one.
Oh, wow. Right. Yeah. Now I understand,
Caroline,
what I'm looking at.
And so what I do is I take a photograph, a high-pix photograph, And then using Photoshop, I cut figures out of them, very often from pulp magazines.
Oh, wow.
And then I put a filter on them to make them look like a painting and print them on canvas. So they're not really paintings, they're fake paintings, but I like to think they're real art.
I know, I like them. I mean, like, I genuinely, I'm impressed with those two you just showed me. And I've never heard of this before. And so, like, just seeing that, when I saw that thing about fake painting, I was like, I need to know what that is, because otherwise I'll be listening to what you're saying, and in the back of my head I'll be thinking halfway through the podcast, don't forget that question, don't forget that question, and I'll get distracted in my own thoughts. That's really clever. That's really clever. When, how did that come about?
I was in a restaurant in Asheville, North Carolina, and I saw a painting hanging on the restaurant wall, and I thought to myself, that doesn't look quite real. So I asked the server, was that actually a painting? And she said, no, it wasn't. And I publish a blog, and I'm pretty good at Photoshopping to
Okay.
illustrate my blog. So I decided I'd try my hand at this, and it's been fun. I've had an art show. I've sold a few of them. So it's been fun.
Nice. Is there anything that particularly inspires you when you're doing it?
No, same with my. I just get in. I'll just get an idea and do it, and it doesn't take long. It takes about 2 or 3 hours from start to finish.
Okay.
And I like to think of them as narrative that complement my fiction writing.
No, I mean, it's a great way to tally things up, and it reminds me, rightly or wrongly, it reminds me of the old LPs where the album art cover would give you, potentially, there was supposed to be an insight into what the songs might be about, and you'd often see
Yeah.
that link between the picture and then the music that was in the album. And so it's kind
Exactly.
of,
It's just the anniversary of Jethro Tull's Aquaman record,
I didn't
and
know that.
there's a good example of the album art underscoring the content of the music.
I find it hard sometimes when I'm 49. I'm 50 later in the year, and I find it hard sometimes when I'm talking to much younger people about music, and they don't understand about album art and how once it was just as important as the songs themselves. I mean, and they're
Yeah, I miss albums because you had a front and a back. Very generally, the first song would be a rocker, and then the last song would be like contemplative and more serious. So I miss albums.
And that's what I mean, because when like trying to explain to them that once upon a time you'd go and purchase some vinyl, like an album, and especially if it was a double album and it could fold out, and there might even be some literature inside, and that whilst that was playing, you'd put that on a record player, you'd then be immersing yourself in the artwork and the literature that came with it. And it just,
Exactly.
and they're just like, I've got iPods, I've got AirPods, and I was like, it's not the same. It's just not the same. You know, sitting in your
Right.
bedroom, sitting in the chair or something, just the whole experience has just, it's gone. I feel like something's been robbed from, a bygone era. It's,
I agree.
you know, it, so I suppose we should actually start talking to about the book, which is Today, Oh Boy.
Correct. The title actually comes from a Beatles song, A Day in the Life.
All right.
So I heard the news today, oh boy. And since it takes place during the course of one day, actually over the course of 8 hours, I thought it was an appropriate title because it can mean for some of the characters, it's today, oh boy. But for other characters, today, oh boy.
That's the power of a sentence, isn't it? Is the tone and underlying context that you can apply to it.
The ambiguity creates more meaning than being dried, I think.
So how did the book come about?
This sounds pretentious, but I listened to Joyce's Ulysses on 40 compact disc, and once you get past the first couple of chapters, it becomes hilariously funny. And I
Okay.
thought to myself, it would be really nice to try to attempt this on a much smaller scale rather than Dublin in 1906, Somerville, my hometown, in 1970 and have the action unfold through the perceptions of various characters who see the world in different ways. And yet from these different perspectives, you're creating a work.
Do you mind if I ask you a slightly different question?
Not at all.
You said it might sound slightly pretentious, but why would it be pretentious to try and do something because you've been inspired by something?
Well, because Ulysses is almost universally hailed as the greatest novel of the 20th century.
So,
and it's
yeah, and, but I don't think it's... Surely it's a compliment, because like you say, if something's held in such regard that everyone regards it as one of the greatest things ever, it surely should come with the ability to inspire people to try and do something, whether you're trying to do it to a greater level or just to the best of your own ability, or just fill yourself up with the joy of doing something.
Yeah. The thing about Ulysses that really interests me is how things are happening simultaneously in the moment. In
yeah.
fact, I read somewhere, I'm not quite sure this is true, if there's a cloud that passes over a conversation and later that same cloud can be seen in a different location in a different form. So you have, there's one little scene in Taddeo Boy at the end of chapter two where every character you've been introduced so far is doing something at the same moment.
Yeah,
And it sort of puts it together. And one of the themes of the novel is how fluid time is, how it drags if you're in class and you're bored, and how it flies if you're having fun or you're in danger.
Because that's something that is interesting, isn't it? Is how you can have two people in the same room experiencing what's going on in different time frames because of how they're receiving it and how they're either tuned into it. You know, like I remember when I was at school, certain classes like maths or a science class, I'd be in terrible trouble. That's like the handle of time scraping across my eyes. But if I was in a history lesson, it flew by because I just could immerse myself in what we were doing and I loved it. It'd be different, you know, someone else would be having the same struggle that I would be having in maths or science.
Yeah, and it's very fluid, time is. I remember sitting in math class in the seventh grade, staring at the second hand being dragged like a mule, dragging it, not moving at all. But like you say, if I was in an English or history class, time was zip by.
What is one of the things that there's a difficulty in what you've written in the sense that you've permitted yourself 8 hours? Because normally when people write, they kind of, you know, you get the classic beginning, middle, and end. But they almost try to stretch out the time frame to give themselves time to write. Whereas you've not given yourself that luxury. You've actually... I'm trying to think of a better way to articulate this, because it's almost like you've yourself off and given yourself a deadline anyway by saying, right, I've only got 8 hours to tell this story.
Yeah, the novel has two parts. Part one is called Surfaces. And what happens, I tried to have every page be a minute.
Oh,
and you're
clever.
In a classroom. And so 45 minutes per chapter, but you go from class to class. You're not stuck in the same room. But then there's a lab experiment that goes wrong, and they have to let everyone in the school out. And that begins part two, where time is much more fluid. It's not regimented by clocks, and the action really heats up. There's actually a car chase and a fight, and so the second half, I didn't regulate time. I just wrote it till I had all the, as Kirkus reviews put it, all the copious subplots tied in a little knot.
So how do you approach your writing then?
I just make it up as it goes along. To me, the most important part of writing is creating characters. This novel takes place in a high school, so you're going to have types. You're going to have jocks. You're going to have strict teachers. You're going to have cool teachers. But I try to imbue these characters with personalities so that the readers care about them. Tell you one little quick anecdote. Caroline and I hang out at a bar called Chico Feo on Folly Beach, where we live, which is a sort of Charleston, South Carolina's version of Key West, Florida. It's bohemian. It's funky. And at Chico Feo, tourists come, and this couple came named Kitty and Jim, and they asked what I did. And I said, I'm a retired English teacher. I have a novel, The South, and they asked about the novel, and I gave them a card showing where they could buy it, which is everywhere. You know, you can get it anywhere. And then 2 months later, I got an email from him, and he said, Wesley, I don't know if you remember me. I'm Jim from Jim and Kitty. But we just finished your novel and we absolutely love it. And he said, I got so angry at the principal in the school, and he started talking about the characters. And then he said, which was the highest praise I can imagine, he said, I don't read very many novels. He said, but now I think I'm going to start reading novels.
That's a good compliment.
It is.
That is a good compliment. So, how do you take that on board then? When, because you know that's quite an impactful thing to have on somebody's life.
Yeah, well, I didn't intend to have any impact on anyone's life. I'm just trying to amuse people and to write what I know about, which is teaching. And I know, I didn't like high school when I was in high school. I hated it. It was 1970. I was a hippie. I lived in a small southern South Carolina town where we had people who hated hippies, who liked to beat us up. And so in addition to the regular horrors of adolescence, you had physical danger added. So I just wanted to capture not only that period, but the art of teaching. What's it like to teach? And as I've said before, I've been sent to the principal's office as a high school student. And I've sent other people to the principal's office as a teacher, and I've been summoned to the principal's office as a teacher. So it's high school is fraught with conflict. And I believe that's why so many movies like Mean Girls, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, et cetera, have such popularity over the years, because high school is high school no matter what decade it's set in.
Yeah, because I think of things like The Breakfast Club. Which was massive in the 80s. Do you mean? Because that was my era. That was my time. And there is something. We had this fantastic book over in the UK called The Diaries of Adrian Mole, who was 13 and three quarters, I think it was called. And it just captivated the entire UK when that came out. Every teenager just read that book. And then there was other books notable of that I remember growing up with was Outsiders by S.E. Hinton, which was became a film, which again, and it's always high school angst, teenage angst. When I look back at my teenage years, and you would probably have more insight to this with your experience in high school. One of the things I think teenagers find incredibly difficult, regardless of when you were a teenager, is you're desperately trying to discover who you are, but you're also desperately trying to fit in, and the two do not connect.
So, that's well said, well said. And one critic mentioned about the novel, I think this is true, that when you're a teenager, you think you're the center of the universe, and at the same time that you don't count.
Yes. Because this is just weird trying to discover where your place is in the world, but you don't know how to do it. So you feel that you don't exist, or there's no importance to what your existence is.
Yes. And teaching, the only thing about teaching I miss are the students. Because essentially, as a teacher, you get older and older each year, and the students remain the same age.
Yeah.
And it It keeps you young in a sense.
Did you ever experience the children of people that you taught and then the grandchildren of people you taught?
Yeah, well, I've taught students and then the children of students, but I didn't last long enough to ever teach a grandchild. Though, so some of the students I taught had were married, but no
Yeah.
grand. I never got to teach a grandchild, literally.
Because it must have been something like strange and familiar when you're teaching the child of somebody you've already taught.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's sometimes they would even sit in the same seats, almost as if they were genetically programmed to want to sit in a certain
Did that
place.
ever sort
But
of give you goosebumps when you sort of, you could have also been talking to them 20 years ago?
it was. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and the school where I taught, Porter Gaud School, is a prep school, and so it's not very economically diverse. For example, Stephen Colbert is a alum, and he was I didn't teach him, he had graduated by the time I taught. But you have a lot of really engaged, interesting students who are very ambitious, most of them, not
Yeah.
all.
What in the 30, was it 34 years you were teaching? Is that,
Yeah,
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah. What changed in those 34 years, but and what stayed the same?
Okay, one of the things that changed is that Charleston, South Carolina is a very old traditional town. And when I first started teaching in the fall of 1985, most of the students were the sons and daughters of old-time Charlestonians who weren't all that engaged in their children's success. They didn't helicopter, as the term is. They
Yeah.
just let the kids do what they want to do. As the decades progressed, however, parents became more and more involved in the children's academics. And once we started posting grades online, sometimes the parents would be online all the time, and would immediately send an email. How did Reginald happen to make a 20 on this pop quiz? And I'd say, well, he didn't read the lesson. Yeah.
Yeah. What didn't change? What stayed the same?
The nature of adolescents themselves
Yeah.
and the subject matter. And it's like in the cultural backdrop of today, oh boy, these kids, even though they're wearing bell bottoms and growing their hair long, if you trans teleported them to 2024, they would be essentially the same people.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Something I wanted to that popped into my head when we were talking about teenage angst and the books and the films. Well, the books primarily, but I mentioned a film which was called The Outsiders, which was a book by S.E. Hinton.
Right.
Something else that popped into my head, and there is a reason I'm asking you this. I don't know if you remember the film back in the 80s, Footloose, with Kevin Bacon. And
Yeah, I saw that.
it gave this kind of that he went from a large city, whatever it is, and had to go to a small town, a Christian Bible Belt type town, and it was a complete contrast to everything he did. One of the things that the film doesn't get enough credit for is how it perfectly set up life in a small town, the farming, and but teenagers are still teenagers. So although you're from the city, we're still teenagers and we're still trying to get girlfriends, we're still trying to get boyfriends, and everyone's trying to struggle. But it set up this kind of image of what that lifestyle was like, because he was used to the city and suddenly it was all tractors and pickup trucks and dusty barns and farming. And so what was that life like back in 1970? What would that sort of town look like for you? And for where the book is.
Well, the town was a lovely little town with oak trees and wisterias, and the population in 1970 was 3,500 people.
Wow.
So virtually everyone knew everyone else. In fact, I when I first started smoking marijuana, rather than buying rolling papers, I would buy chewing gum and wrap up the weed in juicy fruit papers, because I knew the woman who sold me the rolling papers would know my mother.
Wow.
So now the population of the town is 57,000 people. It's the seventh largest city in South Carolina.
Sorry, can I? You said did you say in 1970 it was 3,500 people?
Right.
And now 57,000?
57,000, yeah.
From 3,500?
Yeah.
Jesus, that's a massive jump.
And that's part of what the novel's about. The novel is about this town is beginning to change because you have an influx of Northerners moving south and industry coming to the south. And so that creates a sort of cultural shock for the Northerners who come in. And then for the Southerners, it was, no one likes being told you're wrong about certain things.
Yeah,
and then integration, our school had not been fully integrated in when the novel said it was integrated the next year. We had a handful of African American students who were sort of handpicked, like the American baseball player Jackie Robinson, kids mm-hmm. who would be thick-skinned and talented. So the town was going through its adolescence, the beginning of its adolescence, as the students were going through their adolescence.
What would a day in 1970 look like? Because I'm trying to get, like you were saying, like around that era, you were a hippie and you had the politics going on in America at the time. So, but in a small town, that's harder.
Yeah, well, we had a handful of countercultural people. I would say in the whole school, which the school is famous for its football program. Its coach, John McKissick, the late John McKissick, has won more football games than any other human being in America. And he was there for years and years. And so it was football, football, football. And we hippies were rebelling, so we would not go to the football games, which would make us, we were dressed differently. And this caused even some of the preppy people to disavow us. In fact, I sort of changed my whole friendship set in my last 2 years.
I can imagine in 1970, based on what you were saying, that there was only two things that mattered in life in that town, Jesus and football. And don't believe that Jesus came first.
No, it's remarkable. And the mighty Green Wave, or the Somerville Green Wave, and it's still a big deal.
Yeah. But there's in 1970, something I think that I often have this discussion with people, and when they ask me, like, you know, what's the difference between like when I was a kid and what and now, and I say that I'm not saying it was easier back then, but it was simpler, and that's not to say it was easier. There's a difference, but I can imagine, and I'm going from the culture of the comics I read, and the books I've read, and the films and programs of America at that time. I have this image of a real hard ass sort of sheriff who, you know, the town sheriff who would have sort of like always been on your back.
Yeah. Well, in the novel, there is a police officer named, and he plays a somewhat their significant role, because in the background of the novel, when the novel begins, there's been a mysterious death. A student has fallen off a bridge or jumped off of a bridge. And it takes place the Monday after that occurred. And the students some of them are heartbroken, and others really don't care because the guy was a bully.
Yeah.
And so as we go through the novel, one of the characters, Rusty, is kicked out of school because his hair is too long, and he decides, and so he doesn't have a car, so he has to hitchhike into
Right.
town to get a haircut. And the girlfriend of the deceased boy, whose name is Sandy, picks Rusty up hitchhiking. And because a note has been delivered to one of Sandy's friends stating that Sandy might be thinking about ending her own life, the police are after her. And she drives a red Mustang, which is prominently displayed on the cover of the book. And so as she and Rusty are bopping around town, the police are after them. And once the school's let out, everyone descends upon the town, and you have melee. All hell breaks loose, in a sense.
Because when I think of the kind of culture at that time in 90, sort of 1970s, there's the preceding that the sort of 50s and the 60s. You had like Buddy Holly, Marlon Brando, James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, and we kind of went from this black and white era into the color era. But it's kind of when I. The image I always have, because I idolized James Dean when I was a kid, and it was that, the blue jeans, white t-shirt, cigarettes, your Marlboro Reds rolled up under your t-shirt sleeve,
Right.
and then we went into the 70s, and I was born in 74, so the 70s isn't really my era, the 80s are. But it kind of then became more sort of flamboyant and relaxed, and it was almost N cool to not be cool, whereas the whole James Dean thing was about that era of of that kind of kid on the motorbike and all that. Was it was being rebellious, but it was a conservative rebellion, if that makes sense. You still had
Yeah,
morals, you still had standards, whereas the kind of the hippie culture, which kind of there was much more, it was much more relaxed and about emotional freedom.
the 70s is an interesting decade because it starts out being the 1960s. And then once disco comes, I mean, if you look at 1973 versus 1976, it's almost as if 20 years is to have transpired as far as the cultural situations going. And you're right, the hippies sort of faded away and became disco dancers.
But because it is, it's, I mean, that's a really good sort of point that you've just made. That if you look at the transition of music and culture through the 50s into the 60s, you can see a sort of curve as it goes upwards. Do you know what I mean? And you can see the transitions. But when it went towards the hippie era, it's almost like, well, hang on, how do I join these dots together? And then it goes to disco by the end, by the mid 70s. And you're like, oh, hang on a second. You guys aren't even on the same page. There's no connection that you couldn't be further sort of polar opposites to where we've come from.
It's and of course, ha having the novel take place in one day, I don't have to worry about any of these cultural transformations, and it's no, the thing, when the chemistry lab is left, the whole school is released. This is sort of based on what ha something that happened at my own school, Porter Gaud, where a pipe broke and they had to let everyone in the school out, and you have all people screeching out of the parking lots, and everyone, including the teachers, are delighted that school is unexpectedly
Is there anything in the book that you haven't experienced
Oh,
or witnessed?
virtually everything is made up. Some of the characters are based on amalgams of people, but the only thing that really happened is I was kicked out of school for having long hair and hitchhiked to get a haircut. That's the only thing in the entire novel that actually takes place.
But in 34 years of teaching, and you're writing a novel about high school, is there anything in that that you hadn't witnessed? It might not have happened to you directly, but in those 34 years, you hadn't seen that happen or witnessed it for yourself.
Yeah, the novel is very cinematic, and we have, I'm going to use an old-fashioned term, which some people might find offensive, rednecks.
Yep.
These people who like beating up hippies, and there's a high speed automobile chase where rednecks in a pickup truck are chasing Sandy and Rusty and another character named Molly. And so I've never really experienced anything like that, a high speed
Yeah.
chase. And I've seen fights. So there's a fight that takes place outside the pool room, which was the gathering place for males there. And I've seen lots of fights in
I can
Somerville
imagine you
during.
have. Yeah.
Tried not to get involved myself because I was a 130-pound weakling in high school.
There you go. It's good to, it's always best to know which lane to walk in.
Agreed.
Yeah, you know, sometimes take your time. There's no need to overtake. Just stay in that lane. You'll be fine. The destination is at the end. You don't need to rush to get there. And in those, I've got this. I don't know why I've got this fascination now for 34 years as a teacher, because of primarily, I think, because of the decade you would have covered, which was so contrasting. Did you kind of start your career off as a teacher, getting like you'd be surprised when something happened, and then by the end of your career, you're like, yeah, no, nothing surprises me now. They're all capable of doing so many things, good and bad.
Yeah, when I first started teaching high school, I'd only taught college before. So I really underestimated the immaturity of my charges.
Yeah.
Like the first day of school with the seniors, I ask them, well, tell me a little bit about yourself. And then they start saying, well, I'm a cocaine dealer, being facetious and joking. And I realize that, man, this is a whole different world. I have to, switch my approach. And by the end of my teaching career, I was absolutely comfortable as I could be. And not to boast, but I had a stellar reputation. People wanted me to be their teachers. Their parents wanted me to be their teacher. And so it was
But that's an
wonderful.
achievement to be proud of. When a parent wants you to be responsible for their child and to be an influence on their child's life, that's probably one of the best accolades you can have as a teacher.
Well, I learned so much from my students. I know that sounds like a cliche, but I really did, and I miss them. But may I hold up the cover of the book? Because,
Yeah, of course you can.
of course, I think it's going to be backwards, right? The lettering.
Okay, yeah, but that's okay. No,
Okay,
that's fine. Yeah,
there.
today, oh boy.
Yeah, that's Today, Oh Boy, and that there's what's.
There's a red Mustang, and there is a beagle dog or a basset dog.
That's a basset hound, and there's Rusty, and there is Sandy. And
Yeah.
so that's sort of the cover was done by a friend of mine, David Boatwright, who's a really, really great muralist and a very prominent Charleston artist. And rather than having Austin McCauley do the cover, because all the covers look the same, Carolyn said, why don't you ask David?
Yeah.
And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll do a painting. So that's actually based on a painting.
Oh,
I'll
wow.
sell the painting and then I won't charge you. So you did it for gratis.
There's an interesting detail in both characters. And is it Rusty? Is Rusty the boy?
Yes.
Yeah. Because he's got that typical sort of mechanic denim jacket on with the white logo.
Yeah, well, what
And Sandy's
the
wearing
actor.
the hippie headband, the little string headband.
Well, actually, what Rusty's doing, and he got in trouble for this, that's not the shirt's out of dress code. It's not his shirt. He traded something for it to a service station attendant. And actually, on the shirt, it says Buddy.
Right.
Not Rusty, but that's one of the reasons he's kicked out of school for his hair and also for being out of dress code.
Yeah, no, that's a really good that is a really good cover, and it's nice because you see the contrast of two characters just in the way they're dressed.
It's sort of, I want to like It's not a YA novel, but it's you could call it a pulp YA novel.
Yeah.
And so this sort of gives like a little Hardy Boys on pot vibe.
Yeah. But it's that if somebody is from the 70s, they understand what that is. But it's almost got that, and I mean this as a compliment. So if this comes out as clumsy, please don't. It's not meant to be that. It has almost that pulp B movie look to it.
Yeah, it does. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Thank God that was received correctly.
yeah, no, it does. And I sort of wrote this with movies in mind.
Yeah.
That it's fast paced, it takes place and is written in the present tense. Everything is visual, you can visualize every character. And the critics have really lauded,
Yeah.
praised the characterization. In fact, the Kirkus Review's headline is "Dazzling characters front this quietly sublime period piece." So it's just hard to sum it up. It's fast paced, but it's literary at the same time.
But that's an interesting concept again, isn't it? Because being fast paced in an 8 hour dialogue, it's do you mean that there's these contrasts or constant contrasts?
Yeah, and it's sort of, to use a movie term, it's quick edited. You'll be in a class for 4.5 pages, and the next thing you know, you're in another class or you're outside of school. So, in the 45 minutes of a period takes, you go from several different places at the same time.
What? Why did it take you so long to write a novel?
To write the novel?
Well, because you mentioned the Ulysses inspired you, but there must have been more to it before ever listening to 40. Was it 43 CDs, 40 odd pack CD?
40, yeah, 40, yeah.
Yeah, right. So, was it? Would it be fair to say that that was the final prompt, but it was brewing long before that had ever happened.
Yeah, probably because, I'm not very much in tune with how I create things. It seems to me they come to me. And when writing this novel, and I've written one other novel that wasn't published. And this, it just came to me. Every day I'd go upstairs in this very room and write for about an hour. And when I knew what was going to happen next, I'd quit writing. And
Yeah.
this was at the end of school day. Before I became a teacher, I was publishing short fiction and having some success, but my late wife had a baby, my baby, our baby. And then she wanted to stay home with him. And she was teaching psychology at a college. And so I had to get a job. And I luckily got this job at Porter Gaud. But it took up almost all of my mental dealing with the students, dealing with the new. I didn't have time to write or didn't have the mental energy. But once, about 10 years ago, when I wrote this, I had things better under control.
You mentioned your late wife, and there's a line in the press release that was sent to me, and it says, "I should add that reading literary fiction teaches you that suffering doesn't make you special; it makes you human."
Yes. That it's interesting. Coincidentally, one of my former students, who's probably in her, she was graduated in 88, which is husband passed away suddenly from a stroke. And on Facebook, I offered condolences and mentioned that, things are all different. But having been through this, I realized that words really don't help you. But, suffering deepens you. That I have this theory that's sort of borrowed that, if you look at something like the Odyssey with Odysseus or the Aeneid, all of those epic poems have the epic hero going to the underworld,
Yeah.
Hades, hell. And when they go there, Odysseus gets special knowledge from Tiresias in hell, and he takes that special knowledge and brings it up to the outer world. And I think that suffering sort of works that way. That you don't want to go through it, it's horrible, but once you emerge with a greater depth, if that makes any sense.
It does. Sometimes when I look back on some of the difficult periods of my life where I've definitely struggled, occasionally I get this glimpse of gratitude for that moment, which is difficult even today to comprehend why would I be grateful that that happened to me? Because it hurt, you know, and it could be a breakup or it could be, you know, financial trouble or stuff that I've got into. But that there's an integrity that comes with suffering. And because it's only happening to you and nobody can fix it for you. And somehow you're the one that has to walk along the path until the path changes.
Yes. And you know, this Dostoevsky's great theme, suffering. The Brothers Karamazov, Crime and Punishment, all of his protagonists suffer greatly and they emerge from the suffering a changed person for the better. But I'll go ahead and say I'd prefer not to suffer.
Yeah. I would definitely say, you know, it's not suffering for anyone that's ever coasted through life easily. Trust me, I hate every fathom of your body. If you've never suffered anything, I don't like you. We can't be friends. I will be so envious and jealous of you all the time, you know, to know that you just glide through life and everything is a water off a duck's back. You know, because I'll know that you're just right. And that I should pay attention and listen to the valuable lessons. And my stubbornness will say, no, don't do it. Don't do it. Keep hurting yourself. Keep hurting yourself. But I just want to finish, if I may. Is there anything you want to add before I ask a couple of more questions?
Caroline, should I add anything?
Wow, we could always go on and on and on. This whole process of this novel has been really fun because everybody sees something different in it, and getting readers' reactions. One of the things that stands out to me, and I heard you say you were coming up on 50, and so you and I are in the same generation. We're both Gen Xers. Sometimes people ask, what generation is this book for? And I really had a hard time thinking of how to answer this question. I mean, obviously, boomers are going to love it because they were in high school in 1970, and there's so many really neat cultural signposts and references and things that they'll identify with and trip down memory lane, the sentimental aspect, but also, you know, it's just a lot of fun. But I, as a Gen Xer, loved it because I feel like you, I love those high school movies, like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, my
Oh,
favorite.
what a classic.
Candle, Breakfast Club. You know, Clueless is still one of my favorite movies of all time, even though it's not an 80s movie. But like, I just love these high school movies, and it really has that, not just because it's set in high school, but also because it's very cinematic. Like, I almost, you could almost call this as much of a high school movie as it is a book. And you know, all along we've been thinking this is really perfect for a movie. Like, hopefully it'll get picked up, and we're not sure how to go about that kind of push, but anyway, that possibly is in the future. But you know, going back to the generation question, and then you have millennials, Gen Z. I mean, I think they all can relate to the universal adolescent themes in this book. So it's really hard to answer the question, who is this book for? Because I think all, you know, even my daughter who's 15, you know, all generations who have been through the high school situation or in high school would enjoy it. Some of the language is a little bit elevated, but it's mostly literary and it's just slightly above, you know, everyday language in a few places that just talk about literary things or the vocabulary is kind of interesting, but I just love that kind of stuff. So I just think it's for all readers, and everybody likes to say that, but I genuinely think this book has mass appeal.
I think you've made a very good point because when it comes to like high school, what you discover, and history is good at this if people can be bothered to look at history, that there's certain times in everybody's life, and high school is a good example, where the only thing that was different was the era. The problems and the solutions were the same, and the highs and the lows that those people experienced didn't change. Being 13 in the 50s, being 16 in the 70s, it didn't matter what decade you were in. If you were sat with another 16-year-old, you'd actually have a lot more in common than you had in differences. Obviously, if you were born in the 70s talking to somebody in the 90s, the kid in the 70s would be cooler. But that's not your fault. but it's one of the few things that time doesn't change. You know, you still want to be a cool kid. You still want to be individual. You still want to be loved by everybody, liked by everybody. And you also want to be distant. You wake up every single day feeling differently, wanting to fit in differently. And that struggle of how you cope with that past time never changes.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I think Wesley probably did just unconsciously in this book was make it so visual, because that also just underscores the universality of the themes. Even though the 1970s was such a really neat, interesting, fraught, rich cultural moment, especially in the South. But, you know, I think I will venture to say that fewer people read now than used to.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
People are so on their phones, and I'm guilty as well of that. But, you know, reading books, I feel like this book is a book for people who maybe would like to get back into reading, or maybe read fewer books than they used to, because it's just so visual and it just scratches that itch that we all have now of having all of our senses engaged.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, in abstract concepts. I mean, you know, one thing that is great about Wesley's writing is he doesn't ramble. He doesn't belabor a point. I mean, this thing moves, you know, and so I feel like that is appropriate to today's attention span more than anything. That's just something I think is really unique about the book. I know the word unique is overused, but I've really not read anything else like that. That's why I think of it like a movie, because it just moves from one thing to the next and keeps your attention. So
I think this, because you made another good point, is that people seem to be reading less and less, but I think books like vinyl are going to start coming back, because vinyl in the UK has got more and more popular, and it's getting more and more popular every day. Is people just want to go back to having something tangible, that process of having something in their hand, and to be able to, because when you purchase a book, it gives you permission to go and sit away and be on your own and just indulge yourself in your own world. And
yeah,
you know, and so I think where we are, like you say, with phones, 30 second attention spans, I think people will just get tired of that, and they will start. I mean, part of the success of podcasts is that people get to talk for up to an hour and more. So, you know, some podcasts go on for over 3 or 4 hours, and people love listening to them because, oh, actually, it turns out we quite like long form content, as long as what people are talking about is passionate, engaging, or interesting. You know, people like
I love podcasts.
Yes,
you're in a great business. I think it makes you feel a sense of companionship. You know, when you're sort of engaged in a conversation, even if you're not on the podcast yourself, it's almost like you're friends. You're sitting around a circle of friends, around table. And things like that.
And what a great way to spend a road trip if you're traveling in a car to be able to listen to a podcast. And
that almost leads to one of my last questions, actually. But you're right about the podcast is not quite a business yet, but I'm definitely working in that direction. But the best thing about this is I literally get to engage my passion of being nosy and asking people questions. So you agree to come on and say, are we going to talk? And I'm like, yeah, great. And then you send me a load of things we can talk about, and I again get to actually ask about them. And if I met a complete stranger on a bus, I'd never get away with this. but you have a podcast, and everyone's like, what do you want to know? We're here to listen. And it's like, oh, fantastic. That's good. And look, and this is a great example of Caroline. It's just like, oh, no, actually stay in and join in the conversation. I want to be nosy about you as well. And everyone's okay with it. And just like, I can't believe it. It's like, how did this become a lifestyle choice? A question, I like to ask these questions because I'm interested in how people see the world and where we like to go and stuff like that. If you can imagine going back to a period in your time when you was a child or a teenager, and something significant may or may not have happened, but whatever era you were in, if you could sit down in a room with that child now and tell them everything you've done, what would that child say to you?
Wow, what a good question. The child would ask me, the adult.
Yeah, what would the child say to you once you told them the story they were going to have?
He would say, gosh, that's such a good question, and I'm tongue-tied at the end of this. What would the child say? He would say, wow. He would say, bring it on, because it's mostly been good. And of course there are things that I could have avoided, but like a couple of arrests here and there. But other than that, you know, it's been a great life. I'm thoroughly happy now. And despite losing Judy Birdsong, my wife, I found love and you know, just to go all cliche-ish, you know, I got two boys who are doing very well. One lives in Nuremberg, the other in D.C. Brooks, my stepdaughter, is an amazing person. So, you know, I wouldn't want to go back in time. I like it right now, right here.
That's perfect. What would your child like to say, Caroline?
Oh, I just wanted to add to Wesley's. I think that kid would have been like, what, 4 decades in high school? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's probably true as well. What would your child like to be, Caroline?
Go back with the brain I have now and redo everything, because I have had a lot of adventures in life, but oh my gosh, it's been a wild ride. My child would have been like, no, please don't put me through all that.
yeah. Like that.
I've had a lot of adventures for sure.
Oh, excellent. My last question, and I'd like both of you, if you don't mind, by the way, that I didn't ask your permission first. And this one is, again, it's just playful. It's just use your imagination. If you could go anywhere in time, be any place, anywhere in time, where would you go? What car would you be driving? And what music would you be listening to?
No, you go first.
Oh, I'd love to go to Jacobean England and see a Shakespeare play at the Globe.
Nice.
And the music I would listen to, I guess, would be that lute music of the Renaissance. Multi-tonal, complicated stuff. And what was the other thing?
What car would you be driving?
Oh, I'd be driving a TR6.
Triumph TR6. Yeah. Nice choice. Yeah. 2-liter straight six engine. And twin Weber carbs. Twin tailpipes.
Carol, your turn.
Well, being female, I really wouldn't want to go back in time. But if I had to answer this question, I'd have to say right now. I want to be right here, right now, driving this. Because that's the best case scenario for a woman, unless you're the Queen of England. And even then, I think it was pretty hard. But in the future is, you know, I feel sorry for... the really young people these days, because there's so many problems they're going to have to deal with. So I don't know what that looks like. I'm not really scared of it, but if I had to go in a direction, it would definitely be the future. But I do love the aesthetics of the past. I love the aesthetics. I love the, you know, my art teacher back in high school said, you were born too late, because I was obsessed with all the hippie stuff. I listened to the Grateful Dead. And, you know, all the pictures I drew were like 70s. So, you know, that's another reason I kind of gel with Wesley on a cultural level, because my spirit animal is a hippie.
Yeah. No, but, no, I get that, because all through what would be the equivalent of high school in the UK, I was always listening to the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. I never liked 90s music, really. I always preferred. Well,
the 50s, 60s, 70s was the best music.
It just was.
Don't tell anybody.
I'm a big fan now of the 80s, and I did enjoy the 80s. But when we moved into the 90s, which was effectively my early adult life and late teens, I did not gel with the music or the culture at all. I didn't enjoy any of it.
People are always going to find exceptions. They're always going to say, but what about Pearl Jam and stuff like that?
Yeah.
And that's fine. But the absolute effulgence of incredible, just, you know, world changing music coming out of this, just let's just say the 65 to 73. Yeah. I mean, just, you should really, if you're a musician, you should train yourself on that music.
Definitely.
And I was in like 90s, and I had some musician friends who were listening to, you know, 80s music in the 80s and not classic rock, and that it really hurt their ability to write songs. I was like, y'all should have been training yourselves on Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, and like that, because
listening to the lyrics, listening to what they're trying to tell you.
Exactly.
And I want to tip my fedora to the Brits for introducing me to the blues. Mm. Here I am in South Carolina, where, you know, it takes place, and I learned the blues through Eric Burdon and the Animals and the Rolling Stones.
Crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's, again, it just demonstrates the power of music, that it can return you back to home.
Yeah, we're all in agreement with that. We love music.
What? And that is probably an excellent place to stop. Thank you so much for your time. I thoroughly enjoyed this.
Oh, David, thank you, man. I thoroughly enjoyed it as well. And you're an engaging conversationalist, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for letting me be an interloper.
No, I genuinely, thank you very much for joining. I've really, really enjoyed it. So that was Wesley and his lovely wife, Caroline. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please do, as I said in the introduction, do please check out Wesley and his work. And I hope, like me, you're impressed now that you know what fake painting is. And as always, wherever you are from, wherever you believe, please be blessed. Take care and look after yourself.